This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
And as we then kick off the political conversations, I'm going to tell you we're going to have one. And yeah, it's going to be an interesting one because, of course, the UDM is in the House. Professor Mthunzi Mtuaba is in the House. And, of course, he is the UDM Premier candidate here in Gauteng. So, yeah, of course, it's the footprint of Power 98.7. But, of course, lots of other people listen to us and engage and we'll decide how to make the decisions around the ballot box. But here, Professor Mthunzi Mtuaba is my guest, Premier candidate for the UDM here in Gauteng. Welcome.
Thank you. Good evening, and thank you for having us.
Yeah. You haven't been a politician long.
No, I haven't. Well, I suppose it depends on how one defines politician.
Yeah, one frames it.
Yes, I have for years taken pride in that I'm not a politician, but I was told by someone that, no, but you are a business activist and therefore you're a political activist in the business arena, you know. So now I've crossed, I think. It's like crossing the floor in some way.
Insanity?
Insanity comes to mind, although if you follow Albert Einstein's definition of insanity, no, because he would say it's when you keep doing the same thing over and over and again, even though you get it wrong.
Well, you're in the game now. You're going to be doing the same thing over and over again, and you might be getting it wrong.
That's possible.
So the formula might work for you.
That's quite possible. It's quite possible, yeah.
And then we go back to insanity.
Absolutely.
So let me define a little bit about politics for you, right?
Okay.
Since we're there. Politicians, sense of self-importance, don't necessarily do what needs to be done, but will take every ounce of credit for that. And otherwise, status orientation, love being in a room and cameras and those sort of things. So
then I think I've chosen wrong. I think then maybe I need to revisit this. I may need to speak to my leader, President Holomisa, and say, look, you know, I think I made a mistake because those things you are talking about are exactly the reason I'm not a very popular kind of guy because, you know, I cannot stand self-importance. I struggle with self-importance. In fact, I tend to excuse myself when people are feeling themselves. And secondly, I always say that the biggest flaw of humankind is to place certain people on a higher pedestal and create deityship and create gods. And then they feel all important. And in the meantime, we have enabled them to feel this importance, which is very unwarranted, quite frankly. They become inaccessible. And South Africa is one of the leading countries in that.
You know, talking about inaccessibility, and I always find inaccessibility because I'm in the media industry and I've been, you know, engaging with politicians my entire life. And I've always found that before an election, I have your cell phone number and I can phone you and I can chat and accessibility is a thing. I can get you.
Yeah.
And then you get appointed and elected and whatever.
Yes.
And the number changes and there are two or three bodyguards and access is controlled and You are, for the next 5 years, you are inaccessible until the next election.
Well, again, it varies because, you know, I can never forget being on a flight once with a lady who was trying desperately to help all African countries, including South Africa. And we just perchance sat next to each other. I knew her before, but I hadn't seen her for years. And she said, "What is wrong with your country?" I said, "Sorry, what have we done now?" Because you know, there's a list of things.
Yeah, something that always. Yeah.
She said, "The guys, you know, they're so self-important. You can't get hold of them. You need to get hold of a PA who's got a PA who's got a PA to get to the person." And he says, "You know, all we're trying to do is just to help the country to position it for certain opportunities in the global village, but you can't find them." And I think for me, by the way, that is one of the biggest challenges this country has politically. And as a result, I think they don't understand that because of this red tape that they have, even about being accessible, we lose so many opportunities because people are going to go to the next guy who wants to talk to them, who's more available than
they'll,
us.
They'll do business. They'll do business somewhere else.
Yeah.
Let me ask you about The IOE. I don't want to ask you about the IOE, but I want to ask you about the International Organization of Employers. Mm. Social justice, in essence, and politics. I mean, there's something that is relatable, mm-hmm. social justice, mm-hmm. within the political space. Is mm-hmm. it what was it within you that ultimately made you, you know, engage this thing? Was it the work that you were already engaged with in the previous, you know, lives that you have had? You've journeyed many, many lives, actually.
I have.
Yeah.
I have.
And let's for example, show you one that people might not know of, and let's engage the music. Let's engage something,
yes,
that people might not know of you.
Yes. Yes. Yes, I've been very blessed with having many lives. In fact, I'm getting goosebumps yeah. right now because it's a blessing. I think it's
listen.
I'm grateful.
To this.
Yeah. Yes, that brings back such memories. Yeah, this was 2001, 2002, thereabouts. Yeah. Mm. In fact, I go to the same gym with him these days.
Cabello.
Yes, Cabello. We get along in the gym. He trains very hard. But back in the day, people would not know that it was very hard to actually break Cabello into a solo artist because... Mm. He's then...
Wait, explain that. People might not explain the relationship that you were just talking about now in that life.
People will not know that because
what life were you leading at that? What journey
at
was
the time,
that?
Yeah. Well, at the time, I still had hair. I mean, I'm bald now.
Yeah.
And at the time, I was still very immersed in the entertainment industry. Mm. I had started by being an entertainment lawyer. Mm. And the reason I became an entertainment lawyer was because I was completely bored with the law. Mm. It was a bit of a disappointment. But my biggest problem was I tried to tell my mother that I needed to leave law, and she went into a little bit of a traumatic situation in that her biggest question was, so what are you going to be? Mm. So I said, I don't know. I'll try going to business. She says, yes, but what? Mm. I said, I don't know. He says, many people go to business, but what exactly? She says, as a lawyer, you know, people know what to tell, especially when you come from a rural village that, you know, Onyana Wamli Kweka.
And you did grow up in a rural village.
I grew up in a proper rural village. Even today, we still have dirt roads and whatever. So moving on then for me, entertainment law was suggested actually by a hairdresser, a guy that I used to go and do my hair when we used to do the perms and the stuff. And he said, why don't you try entertainment law? The rest is history. But at the time when I was doing entertainment law and I eventually got to being at Primedia Music, people don't know that one of the things I had to do is to lobby for local content in this country. There was no local content. You know, somebody when my guys put up a TikTok page for me said, yeah, but you know, that was Hlaudi. I said, no, Hlaudi is a baby. Hlaudi came 20 years after some of us had initiated local content and lobbied for it. It was the IBA. It wasn't even a CASA. It was the IBA back in the day. And also there were issues of needle time. I lobbied for needle time and got that now as a public performance right that people can actually earn a royalty. But with Cabello specifically, to get back to the discussion, he was a member of TKZ, as you shall recall, him and Tukulo Magesh and Zwai. So we wanted to get solo acts from all three. We managed to get Magesh and Cabello. But the biggest problem was that his record company at the time, BMG, was headed by a guy whose name I'm not going to mention. He was a little bit verkrampt, a very big, very strange white man. And so he and everybody in the music industry was just avoiding him. So I then had to be the one to go and negotiate with him and to get Cabello and Magesh out of the TKZ contract and get them as solo artists. I had to come up with a very innovative contract so that BMG could also benefit from it, what we called an override royalty. I think it was 2% override royalty.
And look at what Bansula for Life did.
It was amazing. I mean, look, today people are still playing it. We still dance to it today. I have it on my playlist.
Yeah, no, it's there.
That brings back huge memories.
Why did you change? Why did you not stay that particular route?
You know, I had two exits from the music industry. The first exit was when I was actually the, what do they call me? I can't remember, but it's the equivalent of a CEO of of ASAMI, the Association of South African Music Industries, which is called RISA today, the Recording Industry of South Africa. I used to travel so much, Denzel, and I was still very young. I must have been about 25 when I was the CEO of the music industry, 25, 26, thereabouts. And I'd started a family early. My daughter was about a year old when I was traveling. And every time I came home, my daughter didn't want me. And it became a very big problem, you know. And my wife, ex-wife, would say, yeah, but you're never home.
It's understandable.
And I thought about it. I thought, actually, she's right, you know. And that was the one thing. The other thing was the guys would call you at such awkward hours, you know, because, you know, the guys in the industry, they perform till 3 a.m., 4 a.m., and then they call and they leave voicemail. It's the last time I had voicemail on my phone. I canceled voicemail since the music industry. And then I decided, no, I need to go home, spend time with my daughter. So for a few years, I didn't travel. Then I came back when I was doing Prime Media. But even Prime Media was not, I wasn't meant to be doing the music industry. I was meant to go into a partnership between Prime Media and another company, I cannot remember, into a technology company. But it wasn't run so well. So I told Prime Media and I said to them, listen, I don't think I'm going to stay here. It was a company called Metropolis. And they said, no, why don't you go and help? Prime Media Music was in a mess and they wanted me to turn it around. So I went the reason I left was because Prime Media actually sold me a very bad deal. They asked me to save the record company. And as we were busy saving it, I mean, we brought labels like Craig David. Craig David's album, I'm Walking Away, was the first time it was brought by me. I competed with the likes of Sony and the likes of Warner's Gallo, and I got the license for South Africa, launched Danny Kaye, launched Ray Peary's I Think People Don't Listen, People Don't Talk, Let's Talk, and things like that, right? And we're coming up. And we, in the publishing, we're representing WHP and another lady, a Minga lady who passed away and whatever you, I can't forget her name. And then all of a sudden, there was shareholder activism within Prime Media, especially by the overseas shareholders. And they said this Prime Media Music thing was a long horizon. It's going to take too long to turn around. And then it was, and the way I explained it to people at the time, I said, you know, I don't know how an abortion feels like, and I probably never will, but I can relate because I was asked to get pregnant. And then when I got pregnant, I was asked to take the baby out.
You were gone.
And I'd amassed a big team of people who came to work with me from different record companies. Somebody just showed me a headline, a headline, and I think it was City Press when I was about 32, 33 years old, where it talks about this music mogul causing a revolution in the music industry at the time. And so I then took a year out. I then forced Prime Media to give me a retrenchment package. They wanted me to go to Ster Kinekor, which I see now is also closing some cinemas. And I said, no, once bitten, twice shy. You retrenched me. You made me retrench my people. I want you now to retrench me.
Okay.
They retrenched me, and then I never looked back. I forced them to take me into an MBA, which I never did. And then I went into the technology industry after that.
Brilliant. And and that's where, because in my early life, I, of course, journalism, but clubbing and music and all all of that, I would have known your existence of that. Yeah. But of course, then politics is happening now.
Yes.
And that's why you're the premier candidate.
Yes.
How does the UDM fall into your lap, or you fall into their lap?
I don't know who fell into whose lap, but the UDM actually is a very interesting story, which I will not get tired of explaining. So I had almost, as I said in the beginning, I'd always told people politics is not the thing I want to go to. So I've had friends who've literally spent lots of time lobbying me to be in politics. And I said, nah, not me. And then, you know, over the last 16, 17 months, I think a lot has happened. I'm back home now. I'm no longer in Switzerland with the IOE and the ILO.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's actually the first time I'm like in 13 years that I'm actually like, you know, in South Africa as the COVID ends. In fact, during the COVID, I was here a bit. I still traveled during the COVID because in the UN, they gave us some special permission. But after that, I'm sitting at home. I'm trying to find my life. I go into a few music deals that I did, by the way. I did a deal between Gallo and Content Connect Africa, digital distribution, because I was home, did my son's stuff. He's a hip-hop musician and whatever you. And then as I'm doing my stuff, minding my own business, I start having this big political battle with some ministers. I'm chairing Productivity SA at the time. And I'm picking up that actually, you know, some of the things that you sort of ignore, I think, or you think, you know what, I'm here for a short while, so it doesn't really matter if somebody irritates me or upsets me. Now I'm faced with them all the time. And then we have this big war with my contract that they tried to invalidate, which they've tried to set aside now, and God bless them because they won't succeed. And then they tried for me to bribe them. And then again, I go public with that. And then one thing rolls into the other, right? And it's, before I know it, it's about 15 months. And right about November, December, for the first time, I feel like, I think I need to go into politics. But I can't figure, oh, what triggers it is that some political parties are trying to recruit me.
Okay.
Yes, on Twitter, everywhere.
And I'm, in the DMs.
Yeah, DMs. No, even publicly. One sent it, boom. Yeah, I had to respond and my people were commenting as well, the people who follow me. And then it started, I think it sowed the seed. And I thought, okay, maybe I should. And if I'm going to do it, I've got to do it right. I've got to do it in an aligned way with something that resonates with me. It's got to talk to me. And then December, I asked these two friends of mine who've always been enthusiastic about politics to say, look, I think you were right. I'm going to do this. So if I'm going to do it, though, you need to find a party for me. So they said, okay. They went looking. And then January, February, State of the Nation address. This one friend in the morning on that day of the State of the Nation address phones me, says, we need to be friends of a channel, some channel where we shall be analyzing the State of the Nation address. And whilst I'm analyzing the State of the Nation address, after that long, long, laborious speech by, by the Tinzualo speech by Cyril, they cross over to Parliament and I hear, I didn't see him come on. So I hear the guy speak and I'm thinking, oh my God, that guy's speaking, talking a lot of sense. So I look, I say, who's that? They say he's the deputy president of the UDM, a guy called Ngabayomzi Gwankwa.
Gwankwa, yes.
So I said, oh, okay. I didn't know him. I'd never seen him before, ever.
So, he's been around for a long time.
Yeah, but I wasn't here, remember?
Yeah.
I was absent, right?
Okay.
So, and I'm playing catch up now at a very fast pace. So I look, I listen to him, and then I say to my colleague, my friend who's sitting next to me, we're both analysts, I said, that's the party. He says, which one? I said, that one, UDM. And then I start being taken into some kind of a retrospective kind of process with my thinking, that I remembered that when the president of UDM started UDM 27 years ago, I knew him. I don't know how I knew him. He sort of...
You couldn't miss him. You couldn't miss him.
But he said to me, I remember he said to me, Gwedin, I'm going to have to come and...
And that's his favorite word.
Yeah, Gwedin, I'm going to have to come and steal you. And the petty candle, I'll come with a candle. And this is Oguba, you know? And then nothing ever happened. I may have reminded him once, maybe 10 years apart, but nothing ever happened. So now because I'm in full mode of thinking, of saying, what am I going to do? On the Friday, I'm thinking about this thing of UDM. I can't dismiss it. On the Saturday, I remember he's following me on X. I've seen him retweet some stuff. So I go, I DM him, and I say, listen, I think there's some very critical matters of national importance we need to talk about. He responds a few hours later. He says, right away, let's talk, prof. And he sends me his number. And then that's how it happened.
Wow.
A week later, I was welcomed into the UDM. Yeah, 19th of February.
Pretty soon. So let me touch on something before I get to the UDM. And as you were explaining the journey, you were talking about you were beginning to have some conflict with some serious politicians, and also you and maybe you know, I was thinking, you know, if you begin to roll with the guys, then you know maybe it rubs off, and maybe that's how you became a politician. You know, as you roll with the guys, then that's what happens. You know, but briefly. In this is just to check with that. Are those particular scenarios done and dusted? Are you parking them? Are they going forward? Retractions were sought. People were laying all sorts of charges. People were defamation was beginning to happen. Are you done in that particular space? No retractions. You're just going forward. What's going on?
No,
there? Pretty briefly.
There's no retractions, and there shall not be any retractions. I'm going forward, and I will not stop until I win every one of them. Because for me, when I went out, Denzel, I think it's important that it was through middlemen that I had received messages that people wanted to do some stuff. And you know, when I went out because, as somebody reminded me, it took someone to remind me, actually, the person who knew me when I was actually at the Rivonia Heroes branch of the ANC, because they used to meet in my building. At Talk IT, the ANC, the Youth League and the Women's League and the main branch and whatever you. She reminded me, she said to me, you know, people don't know, but you've always been anti-corruption, but you've just never been, you know, very activist about it in a way where you prominently are spotted that you're doing it. And I started thinking about it, and I started thinking that actually, there are many occasions in my life where I've always had to step in and, you know, and stand firm against what I perceive to be injustice or what I perceive to be bullying or manipulation or unethical conduct and so on. And in this particular instance, when I went to speak, I actually had hoped that somehow the guys would call a meeting. I thought, you know, they'll call a meeting and they'll say, oh, who are these middlemen? Show us these middlemen. Then I can say, oh, it's that guy and that guy and that guy. But for me, their response to it of wanting me to retract and taking me to court immediately confirmed that, okay, so it's not just smoke here, there's a fire, right? Of course, there's been some kind of political play in terms of the whole state resource machinery being used against me. And you can see it's been kicking the can down the road in the hope that I'm either going to be fatigued mentally or fatigued physically or fatigued financially or fatigued in every possible way, which hasn't happened. And I think it's shocked them. In fact, in some very ironic way, they've enabled me to get into this life, which I didn't see coming. Right, I really did not see it coming.
Hence, I thought that would have been the plug.
No, they didn't see it. I didn't see it coming, but they enabled me because I think in the process, I started thinking, you know, when I went out, I remember I was asked some questions by some of the people that were interviewing me on the different platforms, and I would have to think about the questions they were asking me for the first time. For example, the one person said to me, so now that you are doing this anti-corruption stuff, I started a Mdwaba anti-corruption fund, you know, to help me as well a little bit with financing, although the money never came through. I think South Africans haven't learned that when they support you, they must also support you financially. They mustn't just support you because I had thousands
of... They pray for you.
Yeah, they pray for you and they hope like things are going to happen. But you know, when I was asked the question, she said, so are you now going to start doing anti-corruption work? I'd never thought of it like that. I just thought, I'm fighting my thing. And I said, in the middle of it, I said, actually, now that you mention it, yes, I think that's what I'm going to do. And I hadn't met the person who reminded me about how I've always done it in the past, you know, for me to know that actually this is something I've always done in different kind of ways. Because even at UWC, I did the same thing. I had to fire people on the council that wanted to take me out, and I had marks on my back like you cannot believe. So but once I had gone out, I then realized with the thousands of messages coming on my LinkedIn, the thousands on my X, that wow, this is not about me anymore. Some people are seeing a little bit of light, a little bit of how they can fight something they don't know how to extricate themselves from. something that has become a very systemic kind of corruption situation, where even I was finding every aspect now of South African society has got an element of corruption in it, in that even things you are entitled to, things that you're supposed to get, you have to pay for. You know, people will say, no, if you give me so much, I said, but that's something that, you know, you're supposed to be doing that. That's your job. No, it doesn't work like that, and that kind of thing. Then I realized, actually, we've gone a little bit rotten. And then people were telling me their stories, how their dreams have been shattered, how their lives have been destroyed. But you can see they are caught in it. They can't get out. Some want to get out. Some are enjoying the benefits, recognize that it's bad. But you know what? They've got to survive. They've got to thrive. They've got kids. They've got families and so on. So for me, it was this process. And I kept on introspecting and trying to figure, how did we get here? And the more I thought about that, the more I realized, actually, it's a number of reasons how we got here. But we need to find a way to get out. And that's how I started going and being very vocal about anti-corruption. And then the UDM came my way because of its anti-corruption track record and pedigree. If you look at Ngakula, this speaker who's just who resigned, that was the UDM. It was Nkwankwa and President Holomisa.
He's in essence kept his snout out of the trough
completely.
And he's kept his hands clean.
Yeah.
Prof, let's take a break.
Thank you.
And after that, let's then engage the UDM.
Power Perspective with Denzel Taylor.
Yes, it is 24 minutes to the top of the hour. Professor Mthunzi Mdwaba, of course, UDM Premier candidate, is in studio. Yes, so let's talk UDM, Prof, and let's just go straight to somebody who was telling me the other day and said, I was asking them what their chances were here in Gauteng, and they said to me, you know what, it's gotten so much tougher with what Premier Panyaza Lesufi has been doing. Employing, and the particular initiatives that you do have. So there's a particular initiative, 8.2 billion rand, 500,000 jobs, future skills base. It's about skills and it's training and it's called jobs. A scheduled master plan. And of course, it's talking about experience and knowledge, and all of that is in there. Now, pretty much, much earlier, you'd also brought that particular aspect to the ministers. Hence, you were fighting. And you were asking for 5 billion rand to do it. They gave it to Panyaza Lesufi, but they upped the scales as well. They gave him 8.5 to do all of this. How do you rate? When I said to you, I'd been talking to some other political party, and they said it's gotten tougher since he's beginning to do this. And they actually think that because he's done this, the ANC might actually win this particular battle in Gauteng. Do you have a different view on this particular skills training, jobs, master plan, project, future-based skills, experience, knowledge, all of that clumped together with what, of course, you were proposing as well, and then, of course, the chances of the UDM in all of that?
Wow. Okay, that's a...
I put it to you because that's your space.
Yeah. But you've also asked a question that has got multiple twins.
Yes, go for it.
Very pregnant. So I think let's start by saying that I issued a media statement about 2 weeks, 3 weeks ago at the time that Panyaza and partnered with Nxesi were launching these programs. Because a lot of people, I think, for the first time, the penny dropped.
People were beginning to talk about a relation.
They were beginning to understand now what I was talking about, right? Because all along, there were the believers. There were those who were the doubting Toms. And then there were those who were saying, no, man, you know, he's just another guy who wants 5 billion, wants to take this money, go burn it kind of thing, right? And all of a sudden, there was like an avalanche now of saying, but wait a minute, isn't that your program? Right. So I had to come up with a statement because I had to study it and listen to what they were saying and look at what they were saying. And the gist of it is that it was a very bad attempt at stealing. So and as I called it on one or two interviews, is that, you know, it's sad when people are so incompetent, they can't even steal properly. because they failed to steal properly the rhetoric of my project, of the ecosystem. Because what I built at Tuja with my partners is an ecosystem we call the parallel universe ecosystem, made up of 8 sectors of the economy, growth sectors of the economy, but tied very closely to the UIF, so that you save the UIF from having to contribute and maintain people that are unemployed.
My narrative, you've just brought something into that. My narrative was, in essence, ask for the money, go on mass recruitment, take the accolades for that, and get the votes.
Yes.
You're saying there's something else also going on.
Well, your narrative is correct.
Yeah.
Your narrative is correct. So that's why it's a bit complex. So on the one hand, there's egos involved in that Ngesi was not going to let me get 5 billion because he believes he's probably making me wealthy. I don't know. But I mean, I've been wealthy so many times in the past. Of course, not in the billions. But for me, the billions were going to be put in impactful projects, which will still happen, by the way. I mustn't also talk in the past as if it's not going to happen. But I think other than the ego and the envy and the incompetence, and I think the failure to appreciate what it is that I had put together, because I don't think even now he doesn't understand it, right? There was also, I think, a bigger picture of saying, you know, they need money for themselves, for the ANC and for other things, because I did warn that this was a looting season. There's another element. And if they give me the money won't find its way to anybody other than the projects. And then the other element is, if we give this man this project, he's going to go shine, because they don't see it as shining for the country and them also benefiting from the shine. Because, you know, they could have gone on the stage and said, we gave him that money, that's because we believe. But you know what? I think the disassociation they have with it is based because they are so ego-driven. They don't see it like that. So they were not going to give me a project to create over 700,000 jobs with 5 billion that they can claim to be there. So they had to come up with something that's theirs, that's also going to benefit them. And then this 8.2 billion came. Now, the similarity between this Nasi Spani, and I don't want to mislead completely, though, is that there are some projects that are worth it there. There are some projects that had been there, people who'd applied actually at the time that I had responded to the RFP as well on the projects and whatever. You, one or two people I know actually who are doing real good work, but that's probably, I don't know, maybe 50 million. Okay, let's call it 100 million out of the 8.2 billion, right? Now, the situation with them is that if you look at the Presidential Youth Initiative that's run out of Cyril's office.
Runs for a year.
It runs for a year, 23 billion.
Yeah.
23 billion.
Yeah.
The Minister of Finance gave it another 7.5 billion now. Yeah. So it's like 30 billion, which they split into different years. It runs for a year. They train assistant teachers.
But they don't guarantee you a job afterwards.
You don't have a job afterwards.
Yeah, you don't. Yeah.
You see, at least you're putting it nicely that you don't get guaranteed. You don't have a job. You work for a year. And after a year, you then are creating mental health issues, because now all of a sudden you had this expectation that I'm going to be in a job, and then you're out and you can't come back. But here's the other travesty. The other travesty is that the UIF that in my project I'm trying to save from having to spend, and we run out of cash, like we run out of electricity and water and all the things we're running out of. The UIF works on a four-year kind of rotation. So if you work for 4 years, you get 1 year's contribution from the UIF, right? But now, if you work for 1 year in the Presidential Youth Initiative, you get 3 months. You know, 3 times 4 give 12, right? You get 3 months. So basically, for 3 months, it actually costs the UIF far more money just to process those payments in 3 months. So basically, you're still milking the UIF. So not only do you spend 30 billion in the Presidential Youth Program, but you still milk the UIF in an amount that we can't quantify.
Which is not their money.
Nasi Spani,
it would have been put there.
Nasi Spani is the same. So I think, you know, they decided, you know, they always say the fish rots from the head.
What's wrong with Nasi Spani then?
What is wrong with Nasi Spani is that, first of all, they don't know what they're talking about. And even the title they give to it, they talk about training opportunities, employment opportunities. So they are selling the hope of employment, but not employment, because it's not sustainable and cannot be sustainable just listening to them. But also, if I was going to create 700,000 jobs with 5 billion, they are creating 500,000 jobs, they say, with 8.2 billion. which for me, if you use the UIF's track record of creating jobs, and I want to be kind, let's say at the most they would create 28,000 jobs a year on a budget of 3.1 billion, right? Now, if you take 28,000, if you take 3.1 billion and multiply it to get the figure of, I think the total amount with the 8.2 billion, how much was the total amount? I think it was also 23.8 billion.
Sure.
Yeah, it's 8.2 that came to Panyaza, right? Now, if you take 3.1 into 23, it's going to go about how many times? About eight times, right? So you multiply eight by 28,000 jobs that they've created every year. Let's call it 30,000 jobs. So 8 by 3 is going to give you 8, 16, 24. So the best they can do is 240,000 jobs on this model of theirs.
So let's take logic.
Yeah.
Let's take logic out of it.
Yeah.
Let's put politics into it.
Right.
Right? Let's put politics into it.
Okay.
Does that, however, get him over that winning line?
I don't think so.
Does it? Yeah.
It gets him something. There are those who will be fooled. I mean, you know, and especially when you're hungry and all of a sudden you've got something that's going to take you over for the next 6 months. All you see is beauty and whatever until you get to the end of that 6 months. So there is an element of contribution that it will give him. But people are not stupid anymore. People are talking about this. People, you know, I don't know if you've seen, there are people who go from manifesto launch to manifesto launch because they say they're collecting the clothes and the t-shirts and the caps. So it's a similar and it's a similar kind of thing. People have gotten smart. They're going to go and accept the things you give them, but they know that you're trying to bribe them, you're trying to manipulate them. It's not going to change. They're going to go and take the stuff that Panyaza is giving them, but it's not going to change the vote. It will change some, but not all. Right? Because people have realized that there's a lot of spinning and manipulation that's always at play. And I mean, come on, what kind of coincidence is that, that it happens, you know, on the eve of the election? And so basically you are using state money to give the impression that the ANC is finally delivering when the last 15 years has been atrocious, right?
Let's talk about the last 15 years then. What would... And in your head, be the quick wins before we get to medium and long term. What would be the quick wins? Because if you look at Gauteng, right, it's sort of a myriad of stuff. People talk about the precipice of disaster, and on so many levels, and you've got to turn it around and fix it. And so I could go into City Centre, I could talk about crime, I could talk about Panyaza in his State of the Province addresses, deals with crime as one of the massive big issues that you need to deal with. And people would begin to analyze all of that and criticize it and say, well, you know what, he's looking at it in isolation. You've got to connect all the dots, and crime fits into all of these things, crime at schools, crime at hospitals, crime in all over the place. But what would be the quick wins for the people of Gauteng?
Did you see the exchange between Bekicele and the people of Hanover?
Yes, yesterday.
Okay. You saw what happened yesterday. Because they were making very valid comments and asking valid questions about why he can't just deal with crime simply. And I mean, for me, there is either a lack of a will to do the right thing, or something fishy is happening there. So for me, a quick win would be to restore safety in the minds of people, the minds of children, that children don't disappear. We don't know what's happened to them. Women, gender-based violence, just crime on the roads. These are easy things to do when you've got a police force that needs to just be managed. So management has been a big thing. It's been missing in action. It's been the elephant in the room. The second thing is roads, right? Now, if you look at the budget, it's 165 billion of Gauteng.
For about 16 million people.
Exactly. So, and health and education get the biggest portion. And economic development gets the smallest portion, which for me is crazy. So, so not only is it crazy from a budgetary allocation point of view, it's crazy because the health and education departments that are getting the bulk have got nothing to show for it. they're a disaster. And the disaster, the doctors will tell you, because I have dealt with them, the cardiologists and oncologists, the one time they asked me to come and motivate them at Convention Center, about 800 of them, because they said they were so demotivated, they needed inspiration and motivation.
Frontline workers.
They were telling me that the biggest problem are the people who manage them. They don't know how to manage. Mm. They are very egotistical, arrogant, incompetent people, right? Mm. So it's got nothing to show for it. I'm not saying health and education are not important, but if you look at the sustainable development goals of health being SDG 3, for example, you look at education as SDG 4, quality education, we are rating probably the worst anywhere else, right? But having said that, if you look at the informal sector, you look at that we are 65% informal sector, the opportunities in the kasi economy, in the township economy are huge, huge. You know, even if you don't know what you're doing, if you were to understand how to grow an economy, today I saw the IMF has revised our numbers to 0.9 growth from the 1.2 by the Reserve Bank. And everybody else in sub-Saharan Africa is growing at 3.2. The globe in the midterm is going to go at 3.2. And we're growing at 0.9. What nonsense. Mm. Why is that? Because people haven't understood that other than corruption destroying our freedom, which is our mantra in the UDM, you also have the reality that you cannot build an economy when you're not building your human capital you don't have an enhanced human capital development program. We don't have an audit of skills. We don't know what skills we have. We don't know what skills we don't have. We don't have an employment policy. We don't have an industrial policy. We don't have a future of work, industrial revolution, artificial intelligence policy. We don't have any of these things.
Back to skills.
About the skills. So if you're going to grow the economy, you need to grow entrepreneurs, grow enterprises, sustainable enterprises, sustainable economy. It's not complicated.
Prof, hold that. I'm going to go to Rose in Randburg. Please put the headphones on, Prof. Rose in Randburg, can you hear?
Yes, I can hear.
Yes,
good
Rose.
Evening,
sure.
Good evening, Prof.
Good evening. Good evening, Rosie.
Thank you very much for your time.
I don't even call her Rosie.
Didn't she say she was Rosie?
She was, yeah, no. She's here every night, you know. She talks to us. She's a listener every night. Okay, Rosie.
All right. So I was following this conversation quite closely because it struck a chord in my heart very quickly. And the one thing I want to say, you know how Whitney Houston said about Babyface, where she's like, he writes the way women feel. I love the way Prof builds up a conversation and a narrative. It is sort of, you can see the tapestry forming very early, you know. So I like the detail with which he explains things. But now back to what is really, really my biggest problem in the country with the arts and entertainment. I was going to ask about... what is the feasibility of if the UDM were to have a seat somewhere and probably trade and swap that to instead look at the arts and build some kind of a structure around that? Because if nurses have issues, they have structures, they can go to that links and hospitals all the way up to government, sports, schools, everything the same way. But when it comes to arts, you know, and that's what so many parents in the country are afraid of, letting their children go into music, into any of the creative arts, because you
protecting
are
protecting the artist.
You're simply strung out to dry. So, you know, and I just find the selective and the media opportunities so opportunistic and selective investment into it that it really is, it feels like investment in the arts. Really happens the way somebody kind of wakes up and thinks, oh, okay, is that what's happening? Cool, let's go.
Rose, I'm going to leave it there. I'll take Samuel in Tembisa. Samuel?
Yes, hello, Tenzar.
Shabrur.
I want to talk to Mr. Zawa there.
Good evening. I'm listening.
Yes, how are you, brother?
I'm very good, my dear brother. How are you?
I'm fine, brother. You know, I want to compliment you for bravery, because these ANC top dogs, they're untouchable, you know.
Ask your question, Samuel.
Yeah, I want to ask you that, how far is that case of him and those department problems.
Samuel, I'm gonna leave it there, Samuel, because I think we've touched on that one, and I didn't want to dwell too long on it because I wanted to get to the UDM. This is an aspect, of course, that you're pretty keen on, that Rose would have touched on, is protecting the artists, protecting their rights, getting them to own what they own. You come from that particular space, you understand it. Is there something to further engage there from a policy perspective or from a regulatory perspective?
So as I said, I'm a self-taught entertainment lawyer because when I did entertainment law, there was no entertainment law back in the day. And then became an intellectual property lawyer by focusing on copyright issues and the music and some of the people in sport. So Rosie, as life would have it, or the universe would have it, I've got kids who are artists. So my son is a hip-hop artist, goes by the name of New Edison. Think he's going to be huge. I think he's going to explode into one of the biggest artists. But I think the trick for me, I believe, is there's no enabling environment for artists and the creatives. And I want, it's in my top nine issues, actually. I was checking here where I've made a note about what it is I want to do for the creative industries. But as parents, we also need to be supportive. So what my son gave me as feedback and other friends is that as parents, we also tend to interfere a lot and not have faith in their chosen paths, right? Because, yes, there's a lot to fight for, but you don't try and not show that you've got faith in them, right? Now, having said that, the Copyright Act at the moment is a mess. It's got something called the Fair Use Clause, which is a very mischievous clause, right? And then when you look at the performers' protection rights, it's fairly okay, but of course it's not harmonized with the one of the artists. For example, there's a very good thing in the performers' one where it talks about repeat performances and being able to be paid for repeat performances and whatever. But of course, it has an inadvertent, unforeseen consequence in that now it means if you are an artist and you employ the services of somebody as an extra in a video, every time the video plays, you must also pay them a royalty every time, which is nonsensical, right? And I believe that all we need to do is that for years, there hasn't been a determined, focused building of the creative arts. There's a big war at the moment between Sara and Zizi Kodwa. It's been tweeting every day how boards are not procedurally appointed and they're being ignored. Now, the problem we have is a culture of using artists only when we believe they are good for us to perform. But I found when I was running the music industry that the reason for that is that people respect people who wear suits and ties and go to the office and they see them working from 8 to 5. They don't relate to artists working alone, coming up with lyrics and coming up with beats.
4 o'clock in the morning.
4 o'clock in the morning, and they work for hours on end. Then they sleep in the day. Then they wake up again. And music, even when I was dealing with anti-counterfeiting measures and anti-piracy back in the day, people think, you can steal music because, you know, it's not tangible. You think it's something you can just take when you want it. Yeah. Now, we need to build an environment where people respect the rights of artists, respect the rights of creatives, people in the fashion industry. You can't have a situation as we've had where the Secretary General of the ANC calls people to a meeting on the 16th of March, promises them that this very flawed copyright amendment, which was voted by 230 ANC people in parliament voted it in, right? As flawed as it is, knowingly that it's flawed because they are pushed by some power that happens to be multinational somewhere for this fair use clause, right? But he calls them and he says, no, we're going to tell the president not to sign this bill and we're going to meet you on the 1st of April. Now it's being referred to as April Fool's Day meeting because it never happened. Their people are still waiting now. So they are used to abusing people and spinning and whatever. But I want to say to you, Rosie, we must build, and it's an industry worthy of building. Look at the other parts of the world, where in France, It's big, the arts. In the Europe, the arts are big. In the US, the arts are big.
All over the world.
We need to do is to protect our copyright, protect our intellectual property, protect our talented musicians and fashion people and people who are actors and so on and the technicians that are in the industry. For me, I think this is a time when we actually need creatives more than any other time, people that are real.
Prof, let me ask you in about the last 3 minutes of the interview, and that's how time flies here on Power Perspective. Let me ask you this. 2 seats in Parliament and the percentages, the numbers. You probably, when you spoke to the general, didn't do that homework before.
I had done it.
You had done it. It's a hard climb from where that particular party is to whatever is envisaged. How?
When I, together with my partners, did a management buyout of a company called Talk IT in 2001, 2002, it had over 36 million cumulative losses, assessed losses. It was going down. It employed about 25 people. I came in as a majority shareholder, the CEO and the chairman. We turned that company around to become the top performing training company of high technical skills in Africa, the top 10 in the world. We won Cisco Partner of the Year every year for 7 years, Microsoft Partner of the Year twice in 5 years, and many other things. I went to San Francisco and did the same thing at a company called M Squared, where I was able to turn that around. So I specialize in strategic turnarounds. I specialize in challenges, but I'm also a sucker for punishment. There's also that insanity thing that we talked about, right? This one is probably the biggest challenge to do in 3 months, right? But I believe that we have strong teams. We have a very diverse team that people don't know about. So when I joined, I didn't join alone. I joined with other people. And I can tell you those 2 seats that we had in National, we shall get nothing less. You can bring me here. I'm happy to do whatever you want me to do as a bet.
I'm going to bring you here before the election, and I'm going to bring you back here after the election.
We'll have nothing less than 20 seats nationally. Gauteng, I did not know, was going to be my gig. The leadership of the UTM decided on this without me. I was just informed. That's your gig, okay? And then it's only in the last two weeks, I was told, that's your gig. I can tell you we've never had seats in Gauteng. I can tell you now, we're going to have a formidable presence if we don't win, or if we don't end up through a coalition being the ones who are premier in the Gauteng province.
Yeah, well, that's the UDM.
We're going to make Gauteng respected again.
How? Give me in 1 minute.
Yes.
Tell me what you think the outcome is going to look like across Gauteng.
The outcome across Gauteng is going to be so splintered into many parties. I mean, the decision today by the IEC on those 5 other political parties, of course, skews the numbers a bit, because now they all have to look for a home and decide what they're going to do, which I think was very grossly unfair, you know, and I don't want to talk about that. But I think the for the first time, we are going to have to find some way, as my president says, of regulating how coalitions work so that they work truly to benefit the people. And I think for me, it's a true democratic situation that's happening, and ultimately content and competence is going to change from the sloganeering of old, and he who shouts and screams the loudest is the best. People are starting to want content and competence.
Professor Mthunzi Mdwaba, UDM Premier.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.